Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Spoken Heard. This is Susan Dolby Chase, and today I would love to bring to you our guest, Miss Ebo Barton. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, good. I have been following your work for quite a while. I can't believe how wonderful it is to have you be fifth in the world, and I am so excited to have you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I've been doing so much lately that, it's so cool to be able to talk to someone about it.
Yes, absolutely. I can't wait to get into discussion with you about things. In fact, I know that you've recently been in a whole new arena for you, doing a play in Seattle.
Yes, yes. It's called Rising Up. It ran for 8 nights. It debuted at Gay City, Seattle's LGBTQ center, and it's about it centers around queer community, specifically around queer and trans people of color, femmes, folks with disabilities, and working class people. And it follows the different relationships of different queer and trans people of color in this co-opt house in the Central District, which is a historically black neighborhood in Seattle. And with all the gentrification happening around us, it was a really great way to tell this story from those perspectives and get representation that we don't normally see in theater and also in, you know, in media or, television or film.
Well, that's fantastic. Absolutely. Where did you get the ideas for your characters?
Honestly, like, a lot of the characters are people I know. Me and my co-writer, Sarah Rosenblatt, these are definitely people we know or a mixture of folks that we know. I know that a lot of the main character is me, but her identities are definitely different than my own. Her history is definitely different than my own. But a lot of the sort of personality traits and decision-making I can see myself in. So it's really interesting to watch the sort of how she manifests different things in a way that I wouldn't, but we definitely have similar personality traits.
That's wonderful. And so do you play the lead character and then there are other people in it, or do you end up playing everyone in the show?
Me myself, I feel like I just relate to a lot of the characters, and like doing all the writing with Sarah has definitely I have a personal relationship to all of the characters, but I do play a character named Shay in the play that's very brief, they are part of the open mic scene, the poetry open mic scene, and they don't get to do their poem because of the construction next door. So.
That's sad. I really admire the fact that you're able to conquer what might be difficult subject matter for other people, but, is life for you and you're willing to step out of the shadows and tell your story. Was that difficult for you?
Honestly, yeah. It's hard to, you have to be very careful in talking about, like, folks in your community because their experiences are not your own. And I was very fortunate to have people who were gracious enough to talk to me about their experiences and how to put that into a fictional character. Because oftentimes queer and trans folks, specifically trans folks and trans folks of color in the media, were often seen as absurd or a punchline or something dramatic, like over the top or dramatic. And so I wanted to be very careful about the way these folks were represented. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if people want to see it, I know that there's only one night left of the show, but where would they go?
Oh, they would go to Gay City on Capitol Hill, 517 East Pike Street. We open at 7 p.m. So all of our shows have been sold out for all 8 nights. But there is—I've been telling
wow,
everyone
fantastic.
There's a chance that you can get in. Yeah, there's a chance you can get in on the guest on the waiting list if there happened to be a no-show or something like that.
Fantastic. Hey, I was wondering if I could prevail upon you at this point to share something with us.
Absolutely. This is my poem called Open for Business. You know that new store with all the construction that replaced that bakery, restaurant, boutique, coffee shop? Well, it's open, but it's a pet grocery. The fuck is that? I don't know where they got the idea that people around here could afford groceries for their dog. Rocky eats Purina and leftovers. But ever since that new bus, train, trolley car, subway line, bike lane opened, everything has been water dripping from the electricity of the overhead wires. Like, why'd they take Uncle Keith's place and put in that new restaurant, bakery, bar that no one around here can even afford? It's like they are poking holes on our streets to see if we will leak from them. Every time they build, they rip at our seams, never give us a minute to mourn our holy open graves, put up tombstones we can't afford to look at. You know, Thomas moved. They said his lease ended and the rent for his apartment rose like $300. So he moved 20 miles south or west or north or far away from here. He works part-time at the pet grocery now. Says the commute is worth it. Got a one-bedroom for the same price I'm paying for a studio with a broken heater my landlord is still waiting for me to pay for. It's like what we used to pay. It's like the only place that remembers us is too far to even remember how to get back here. Painting all their new buildings colors we've been using in our artwork for years and calling it new and calling it right. Making right angles of our cul-de-sac blocks. They call it cleaning up. Like we were the mess. They call us a dead end, but they're not calling this a dead end anymore. The city looks like an erector set of a child that wears a suit now. With a big office on the top floor of a building so high up, he has no idea that people still live here. Do you know? Still live here. We've been living here ever since you redlined the rest of the city. We are still living, even if you didn't expect us to. The other night, we were sitting on Union, a group of like 15 white people in little shorts were running, walking, biking down the street. Moni said it was a club. But they never used to want to be here at that time of night. Moni said that Union was never the street to be on after 6 p.m. and be rich and white. But now they're running on our block when the streetlights are on. They're running on our streets like they run our streets, being seen around here like they didn't used to avoid it. It's been so quiet here lately. The silence is so thick you could use dull blades to break it open, find the pain in our backs from carrying the relics of what this used to be, before we were worth saving. Before you tore down the boundary line and started putting up grand opening under new management, open for business as if we have always been closed, unrestrained, only open for surrender. They find our music to play in their coffee shops as if to remember us fondly. It is clear we are unwanted. It is not clear where we should go.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little about that. Where did this poem come from?
So I live in Seattle, and I have spent 10 years of my life living on these two neighborhoods called Capitol Hill and Central District. And Capitol Hill was historically an LGBTQ neighborhood, and historically the Central District has been a black neighborhood. As, you know, Amazon started its growth, as well as, like, all of the different dot-coms out here started to grow, rent started increasing, and a lot of folks, specifically black folks, were displaced. I mean, within a 5 or 6 year period, we went from I think it was 40% of black population to 17%. And so, like, it's just been amazing to see the differences in which, you know, there were neighborhoods that I know white folks that would have never even set foot in that area that are now living in houses in that area. So it's just, it's been really sad and heartbreaking to see, you know, and with the legalization of marijuana in Washington, it's interesting to see how street corners where, you know, black folks and brown folks were getting arrested for selling drugs. These are the same corners in which there is now pot shops. And so, like, it's
ironic
that are, you know, like, you know, and it's just really, and it's owned by rich white men, you know, and so it's just interesting to see the differences in these neighborhoods, and it's heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking to see, and how, like, there's no care for marginalized folks in those areas, specifically in those areas, and specifically in the areas that they're moving to.
Yeah. Well, I love how in the beginning of the poem, you know, bring up the idea that it's not just this one case or one story by using the rapid fire lines about you know, coffee shop, bakery, you know what I mean? I really love that. Have you
Thank
used that
you.
Technique in the past? And what brought that into what makes good poetry to you? I mean, when you read it, how do you know you've got something good?
That's such an interesting question. Well, I think that authenticity is definitely something that makes good poetry. If this is not your story, it's really hard to tell. And so,
exactly.
I think that's something that comes naturally is something that you're actually feeling. And I think that with that particular part of the poem, you know, we experiencing that in these neighborhoods, like hearing these stories over and over and over again,
right,
is where that came from. And it's, so it's sort of this like drummed in your head of like, remember when that used to be right there? You know, when, you know, like, did you know that that's a bakery now? Did you know that that's a whatever it is now, like some weird Fandango hipster thing there now? You know, and so it's like hearing these things over and over and over again. And then like following the, and that specific portion of the poem is like following the sort of process of gentrification, right? Where it's like, first we see this really odd pet grocery in our neighborhood that doesn't belong there, and then all of a sudden all the bus lines now come through our neighborhood, in which case they didn't, you know, or like, or the train, or the, you know, whatever the case may be, and then so like hearing all of those things and how all of a sudden we have to leave, it feels
right.
Very sudden, and but like we hear all these echoes of all these conversations of new and better and clean.
And where did the people with who no longer are there, who have been displaced by the gentrification, where are they going to?
Well, the way I understand it is that folks are moving further south where the rent is still, you know, marginally cheaper, or they're leaving Washington. You know, like it's been really interesting to hear the different stories of, you know, I'm you know, 20 miles south is a city, our sister city, Tacoma, and a lot of folks are going there, but also or neighborhoods that are just south of Seattle, south in Seattle, where the prices are, you know, a little bit cheaper, or they're just leaving Washington altogether.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's sad that you're losing that whole part of your economic base. You're losing so many people who have called Seattle their home.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's your writing process like?
Ooh. I think it varies from time to time, but oftentimes I become inspired a lot by listening to other poets, reading other poets. I think that there's a particular inspiration that happens when you're listening to a poet that you love, is that they give you a permission.
Yeah.
To tell a story that you didn't think you could tell, or that you didn't think was necessary. Even I know that when I'm listening to poetry, I'm often listening for that piece of permission, especially when you hold so many identities that are taboo in this world. You know, like being queer, being trans,
right.
being brown and black, and you know, all of these things. And so I often listen for the permission. So after that, I just sort of like empty it out and then go into the editing process.
I see.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I was hoping that maybe, since we're about halfway through the interview now, if you could read us the second thing.
Sure, absolutely. This one is To My Absent Father. It has been 14 years since I've seen you. Could not point you out in a crowd of three. You left me twice. The first when I was two, And the second, when I was 14, it was as though you could not leave me enough, as though my infant brain could not remember the sudden absence of your screaming voice climbing the walls of all my future relationships, as though it was my fault. I've heard that you and I share features like a dinner I've been force-fed for as long as I can remember, but you won't even sit at the table with me. My memories of you include when I cut my foot at 3 years old and got 12 stitches, you said, I got my heart broken for the first time when I was 14. A girl who could not understand my obsession with wanting to spend every lunch period together for a week. When she said we couldn't hang out anymore because I was weird, I went home to cry too. The day you left, the last words you said to me were, give these keys to your mother. And I said, and I've responded to you like this ever since, are you proud? I learned something from you. Tell my ex-wife that I stayed 5 years too long. I was learning how to stay and not be my father's. Tell my friends that I don't know how to tell them how I'm feeling because, dear missing father, absent dad, the silence screaming in the gaping holes of my emotional inabilities, this is an obligatory letter to my biology that I will leave at the roots of a tree I can't even identify. What is the purpose of explaining who I am to you if you don't even recognize the miracle I've always been? I am. It feels like. You should know this about me. Dear Dad, is it because I am too, or too, that you did not want me, but I still exist. I am so painfully permanent. I am such a miracle.
Wow, that's really, really gorgeous.
Thank you.
Idea of the silence is so unique. I'm not hearing that from a lot of different poets. Where did that idea come from? You do so many interesting things with, like, how you frame things. It just amazes me. Where did this one come from?
Well, I think that, one, there is a poem about silence by Jared Singer. That was, I was thinking a lot about that when I was writing this poem, of how much you can say without saying anything. I think that another thing is that, I think that the similarity, we often talk about the difference between page poets and stage poets, and I think that
yes.
Page poets think about the space that they take up on the page, and
yes.
I'd like to think that the spoken word poets like think about the space they take up on stage or with their voices, and sometimes you don't need to.
Right.
And I think that was what I was playing with, along with the very obvious, like, my absent father didn't really give me any, like, you know, there was no response. So giving that back to him as well.
Right. Right. Do you and your, the man from the poem, your stepfather, you said, do you two still meet, still talk, still have a relationship?
Oh, no. That was my biological father, and he spent 2 years of my life with me, and, I don't,
oh.
yeah, I, Yeah, but we don't speak. I don't really actually know where he is or anything.
Okay. Well, maybe that's for the best, to be honest.
Yeah, I think so too.
yeah. It must be, you know, in some ways freeing to become yourself, and in some ways it seems like it's such a heavy burden to carry to be who you are, Yvel. I have so much respect for how you become your own individual in a world that maybe is offering you that kind of silence in return for your, you know, the hard work that you're doing, the day-to-day struggle that is being who you are, but also the freedom of being who you are. How do you deal with your life day to day, knowing that there are people who maybe are judging you or maybe don't understand? Has it become easier as your life has gone on?
No, Definitely not. I think that there's you know, when they say that ignorance is bliss, like sometimes that is definitely a true statement. I'm hoping for myself that as I get older, that I'm learning more things about myself, but also about the world. And so that does become a burden sometimes. The stage is often my sacred place. And it always has been, you know, like my mentor, Tara Hardy, has always said that, you know, the stage is your business with God and whatever God you believe in. And oftentimes, I'm a youth educator, and oftentimes what I tell my youth when they're going on stage is, people paid money to get in here, and you have 3 minutes to say whatever it is that you want. What are you going to say?
Uh-huh.
And everyone has to listen to you. You know, and so I think that that's something that I take with me, is that I'm given 3 minutes every single time I have the privilege of touching a stage. What is it that I'm going to say?
Yeah.
So and it is scary. And like, how much do you want to present your art, and are you willing to sacrifice? What are you willing to sacrifice for it?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So how long have you been working with youth as like a mentor in writing?
I've been working with youth for about 5 years now, 3 years professionally. I've been working with youth, where I'm actually getting paid for it.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I work in poetry. Currently, I manage a art activism program for LGBTQ youth, where we have weekly discussions on issues that impact them directly. And then they create art around it.
Oh, that's fantastic. Nice.
Yeah, so it's been really, really interesting to see the ways in which they know that they are impacted, and the way that the system is designed to, you know, keep them in a particular place in the world. But then they create art around it, or a film or something like that, and it's just been really amazing to see.
I bet. So do you go out to high schools, or do they come to you?
It's a drop-in program, so they come to Gay City every week, on Thursday every week, and come hang out. We eat, socialize, and then talk about the issues.
Can anybody?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Excellent.
It's just like they bring friends oftentimes, and you know, things like that.
Cool. So if they wanted to get in and see you, and do this, where would they go, and when exactly?
So every Thursday, starting at 3 p.m., and we do a social hour until 4, and that's also at Gay City, Seattle's LGBTQ Center, It is 517 East Pike Street in Seattle.
Beautiful. I hope that people are able to attend, and it's just such a wonderful idea. I just really love that.
Yeah.
And
I think
activism
is something.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. No, I was just saying that.
No, please.
Activism is a part of their life now. Like, I think that's something we overlooked in my generation, and we do it now. But like, you with youth, like, this is part of their life. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I think it's important to note that. I wanted to make sure that I have enough time to get into a little bit about the Individual World Poetry Slam and your ranking and how that all felt and everything. I just really want to hear you talk about that experience.
Sure. I think it was very surreal, to be honest. It's not something that you see your favorite poets and you compete against them, and you don't think ever in a million years that you're going to be on final stage with them. And that's actually what happened. A lot of my, of my favorite poets, Toaster and Frequency, and, you know, like I'm sitting here in like this sort of wide eyed, you know, like a kid backstage with them. And it was a really amazing experience. Like I was, a friend of mine said that in the last round, he could see the joy that was in my step as I was coming out on stage. And I think that, I lost, I don't, I, like it didn't become a competition
after that. It was very much for me a showcase of work, and
right.
I was just very excited to be where I was.
Right. I just, you know, you deserve it so much, and you mentioned Toaster. I have to say
thank
hello
you.
To him because he's one of my faves as well. and you are just like this little powerhouse, and you get on stage, and everyone is awed by what you do. Do you think that it took longer for you to be a poet or a performer? Or both?
Did it take long? Is that what your question was?
Longer, more effort, that sort of thing.
I think that it took the same amount of time to become a
uh-huh.
poet and performer. There was, again, I think I needed this permission, and I'm not sure where I got, like, I probably a number of different places, but I think that there was this permission to perform the hell out of your poem. You know, that
yeah.
I needed. And I think that eventually I got the hint. I still need a reminder sometimes. but sometimes I think I just needed that permission to be a poet and to be a performer. And, like, I think the art
right.
of it all is combining those two things.
Yeah, definitely. And there's so much in spoken word in the, like, the interplay with the audience and your relationship with the audience. And I can see how that also comes to play in your play that you're doing now. It's
mm-hmm.
so important. So when people ask
yeah.
you, you know, what spoken word is, it's almost impossible to define without mentioning that relationship. How do you cultivate, you know, that with the audience? How do you create a relationship?
I think telling the story that is not being told is the way the audience connects, you know,
yes.
and I think that there's either going to be folks that need to hear that story because they don't want to feel alone, because they are also,
right.
there's some sort of relationship happening or connection happening with the poem, or folks that wouldn't ever experience that need to know that story exists in the world.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's part of the connection being made with the audience. I also
mm-hmm.
think that just the invitation of spoken word is just so accessible. I mean,
yeah.
I talk about this often where I say that, like, you know, spoken word and, you know, and open mics and slams specifically, anybody can come and put their name in the hat if they are, you know, if they are
right.
able to be there. And so, like, I think that that's also another thing where it's like, this person, who is this person? I've never seen this person before. And they're reading my, you know, entire life history. And I think that that's part
right.
of the audience connection with the performer.
Yes, definitely. We're coming up on the very end of the show. It went so fast, and I have enjoyed you as a guest immensely.
Thank you so much
for being with us. And
of course,
if I could prevail upon you one, pardon me?
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. If I could prevail upon you one more time to read us one thing out of the show, that would be great.
One thing out of the show?
No, like, read us out of the show.
Oh, got it. No problem. This is one of my very quieter pieces. Skin sings her name in the morning, turns the colors of dragon lily bouquets on a chest I've been mourning. Like she showed up to both the funeral and the resurrection of a body I've been grieving. Like my blood wanted to show up to the surface of my skin to say thank you for seeing us. This is as close to love as I'll ever let myself get. This is as close to safe as anyone has ever let me be. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it so much.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you'd like to come back, you just shoot me a line. Next time that you would like to, and I will gladly have you on the show again. It has been a complete and total delight.
Thank you so much, and I will definitely call
you
next, probably next year.
Okay, sounds perfect. Sounds absolutely perfect.
Okay.
This is Spoken Heard. I'm Susan Dobie Chase. Until next week, be kind to one another.